Accession number 28455, Reel 3.
John Davis, Reel 2. Yes, this is very interesting. I suppose you went through Moscow, did you?
Yes, we did. We went to Moscow and had two, three nights there. It was a wonderful, great hotel from the old regime. I had the impression, great big staircases and so on, and food was terrible. And there was brown water in the taps when you put on a tap for a bath. And sort of brown water came out. It was a kind of inefficient, grand but inefficient. And we were taken on a few tours in leaky coaches with the sort of floppy tops where the rain came through a bit. And a guide showed us bits of Moscow. I have vague memories of that.
Did you go to Lenin's tomb?
Yes. We didn't get out. We just stayed in the coach, but we went to the Red Square and we saw the great walls of the Kremlin and the cupola, the mosques, what do you call them, the temples, churches, and lots of guards, cobbled streets, Red Square, and on the side outside the wall of the Red Square was Lenin's tomb, visible to the public. But we didn't go into the inside the walls, of course, where the Kremlin functioned. But got a good impression of Russia then in 1936.
Yes, and I suppose going across the Trans-Siberian, you would have seen signs of what had been going on. Would you, sort of collectivization and how the people were faring? Did you, the places you stopped at, were you able to get an impression?
Not very much. We went to Omsk and Tomsk and all those weird places. They're in my diary there. And got out of the train and ran about. What did impress us, I know what impressed us, was that the engine was wood-fired and all the loading of the wood, throwing up to the people on top, was done by women. All the hard labour of feeding the engine and bringing on the food supplies and everything, it was all women. poor-looking peasant women. As opposed to, no, we were used to men doing these jobs. And they did pull the blinds down. So I suppose those are the areas where there were camps, there were signs of what was going on, and that we didn't see. Until we got past the Ural Mountains and out of all that, the western side of Russia, where most of the stuff was going on then. And we were watched, and we had all the time, we had propaganda on the train. There was a loudspeaker in the coach, and you had pro-Russian propaganda going on in English language much of the day. Very boring. We found it very dull. We shut the doors as hard as we could to shut it out. We were, I think, four in the carriage. We went second soft. There was first soft, first hard, second soft, second hard, and then third soft, third hard. There were six classes of travel, and we were second soft. The third hard must have been very hard. long trains, corridors, and we walked up and down. And at the end of each corridor, there was samovar. A big tea-making samovar, and we went to help ourselves free tea in glasses, in glasses which were contained in the metal holders. We had tea like that off and on through the day, just plain like Indian tea.
Quite good tea, the Russian tea, quite good, I think, tea. Isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes. Yes, we enjoyed that.
Yes.
And we went to a carriage to have meals, to some eating dining car thing, yes.
Quite an adventure that must have been in those days.
Yes.
You know, to be across the Soviet Union, as it was.
Yes. Mm. We sort of knew what we were doing, especially with the Russians being so strict and obvious, and the military, when they walked through the train to see we were behaving, had their rifles on their shoulders. They were meaning business in full uniform and boots. So we were minded in 1936. We were watched over. We foreigners, you know. There were adults about, I can't remember them, but our gang were. Mrs. Atri, odd enough, was a white Russian. Mr. Atri worked at my father's office. His wife was one of the white Russians who fled to China in the revolution. Whole population of Russians fled east, and a lot of them ended up in Tientsin. And they went to our school, and we had, knew them as good friends and all that. And Mr. Atri was in the army, bought himself out of the British Army, as one could do in those years. He was a ranker or NCO, perhaps, that sort of bloke. Bought himself out to marry Mrs. Atri, who was a Russian, white Russian, spoke English, spoke Chinese, spoke Russian, and joined my father's office for his livelihood. So we knew the Atris quite well, and they'd been over to England for something rather, and were our adult escort back. So it was, we were quite used to this mixed community, which we don't, you know.
You were saying you saw cattle trucks with people in.
Yes.
Would these have been the gulag, you know, people going
yes,
to the
Yes, very
gulag?
Much so. We didn't know the term. We didn't know what was going on, but we could see they were nailed in. It was a cattle truck, and from about above our normal head height, there was the breathing space for the cattle. And sometimes somebody was helped up and peeped out over the top, and you saw a shaven head. Couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. And out of the cattle truck was a tin chute, which was a lavatorial arrangement. All the doors were nailed up, cattle truck doors were nailed and wired up. And the lavatorial arrangement for these chutes coming out here and there for all users, I guess. So we knew they were prisoners and having a terrible time. We could see that, even as young people full of laughter and all that, we realised it was bad and wrong and something we'd never seen before. We were terrified because Henling Wade, another friend of ours in China, was going back from English school. Huge platform we were at somewhere, station. He crossed the platform and he went a few platforms away. And our train started to go. We shouted out, Henling, Henling. Henling Wade. And the adults were terrified, the Atris. And he had to duck between railway wheels of other moving trains and got onto the very end of our train. Came back at us. Some schoolboy things would go on.
He could have ended up in the gulag.
He could have ended up
in
Russia for keeps. Especially as he was slightly Chinese. His father was half Chinese. His mother was an English nurse. And again, we knew the Wades well in Tientsin. We mixed about all nations and all sorts in Tientsin in those years, like anything.
Then would you have gone down through Manchuria?
Yes, we went to my Uncle Lionel, my father's youngest brother, was in Dunlop Rubber Company, out from London, in Mukden, North China, M-U-K-D in Mukden. And he came to meet us at Mukden Station. We got off the Siberian train, which would have gone on to Vladivostok. We got off at Mukden and took a train down to Tientsin. South-going train from the main east-west Siberian train. And he saw us youngsters through. I've got his account here. He was behind the lines in the war. He became a brigadier, doing secret work as he spoke fluent Mandarin, and did awfully well.
I think you became involved with that, didn't you, towards the end of the war?
But yes.
We'll come to that later on.
Right.
Yes,
indeed.
I mustn't preempt
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, right.
But what would have the situation have been? Because the Japanese surely would have been in Manchuria in 31, weren't they?
They were, yes. Mm. Now what we went on a Japanese train, now that you remind me. The train down from Mukden to Tientsin was Japanese-owned, Japanese-run, Japanese-staffed, yes. They were very much in Manchuria, North China. They were also in our city of Tientsin. And they wore rather like the Germans. They wore floppy caps with a shiny peak. What do you call it? That leather. Patent leather peaks. And they all wore mouth guards, the Japanese. They wore sort of gauze below the nose and across the mouth and hitched over each ear, boys and girls. They wore a kind of tunic uniform, boys and girls, and black trousers. And they were very obviously there. Japanese, separate to the Chinese and to us Europeans. So, at Northley Park, they had a lot a presence then, before they did anything that we knew about, that happened later, a bit later, when they decided to take over and created the Manchu War incident, as it was called.
That comes later.
Comes a bit later.
Yes.
I went...
So back in Tientsin, how did you settle in after this very English experience?
Well, it was summertime, so I shipped straight off to Peterho, where my mother and brother Dick and youngest brother Tony were. Anne and I were the two elders. We were shipped straight from, my father greeted us in Tientsin a few nights, and off we went on the train to Peterho, which is this lovely seaside place overlooking the sea, where we had a lovely summer house, holidays house, big long bungalow. And so I woke up the first morning there with my little brother Tony, who's 14 years younger than me, lives in Canada now, was peeping at me and curiously, this older brother. There was a huge gap between us of 14 years. He was a little boy and I was 17. And I woke up there in Peterho, and we had a lovely summer holiday, I don't know, several weeks. And my father came up whenever he could, as a hard-working businessman. He came for the weekends, long weekends, etc., from the boiling hot Tientsin. So my first reintroduction was this holiday place. Then, towards the end of the summer season, we all went back to Tientsin. And the plan was that I should study my father's business, stockbroking. No question of further education. We didn't know my school results. We didn't care much. I'd had my English education. And I was to learn to become a stockbroker. And the plan was, I'd work there in the mornings in his office, during which I'd type my diary, by the way. I learned typing. And I sort of learned bits about his business and met the Chinese compradors and important people in his office. Chatted with them a lot.
Didn't do much. Called compradors?
Comprador meant the, yes. Compradors was the man in the local man in charge. He was a Chinese, respectable man, middle class man. Below him were several ranks, down to the coolie, you know, the basic peasant. But he was way above all that, well dressed, long robes, Chinese robes, and businessman, bookkeeper, boss man, manager sort of person. My father was the owner of this business. He was a good businessman. My father formed up his own business. And then whilst at school in England, two Easter holidays I spent at the Army School of Physical Training in Aldershot, because I loved all this kind of thing, in Hammersley Barracks. And I went to the big gym, the Army main gym in Aldershot, learnt all sorts of things taught by Army School of Physical Training, NCOs, vaulting, bars, boxing, fencing, every sort of thing, running, and I got diplomas in these sort of things. So when I got to Tientsin, I offered my service as to the Tientsin Grammar School as a PT master. So I was only 17. The PT outfit was two army corporals from the garrison, two regular soldier men, who I've got a picture of them here, corporal this and corporal that, and myself. And we ran the physical training of this school. I don't know how many pupils there were. Big school. Lovely big gym. I taught in there. I even taught my younger brother, Dick. He was in the class every now and then. Put him through his paces. Taught them football, cricket, all these sporty things, which I had knowledge. And the NCOs, these two regular soldiers, were adults, of course. They were in their 30s, I guess, real career soldiers, corporals, did their bit. We three ran the physical training, and that was my afternoon job. And I have here, strangely enough, I found before you came, my little diary of my lessons. These are my lesson plans. The lessons I put them through, the games we played, the result of the matches and everything are in there. The terms I don't remember now. Various physical training terms, because I've since become a yoga teacher and learned other ways of describing posture work. But I taught all that stuff, and there's my diary of it.
I suppose one thinks of Eric Liddell with China,
yes,
and sport.
One does.
What would he have been about then?
He was about. He was a missionary, splendid man.
Did you meet him?
Yes, indeed, quite often. He came to the Minyuan. which is the name of the big sports stadium in Tianjin, where I took batches of schoolboys at times for track running and other stadium athletics. And Eric Liddell would turn up. I suppose the school arranged it. And he'd instruct us, this super Olympic athlete. So I met him in person. He was a very nice man, big, broad grin. I got a picture of him giving a prize to one of my pupils, and I'm leaning over looking at him for some running event. So we knew Eric Liddell quite well, and the China Inland Mission were important members of our community.
Yes, I was going to ask you about the missionaries and their role in China at that time. Was it important?
It was. They ran schools for the Chinese poorer people. They converted many to Christianity and became very devout. The Church of England, London, a mission, I think, from London called the Church Missionary, China Inland Mission, CMI. Men and women, usually both partners were in the mission, working away. Quite a large number of our community were missionaries, but they lived in another social strata, of course. They didn't belong to our country club, which required a big subscription, and it was another sort of fishbowl, as it were, we swam in. They didn't come to the balls and go to the races and do those sort of things. They lived a separate, rather discreet, quiet missionary life, different to our normal hectic. With us, cocktail parties went on with the adults, many giddy things, dances and fancy dress balls, heaven knows what. Missionaries stayed without that sort of thing, of course. But we all knew them well and we respected them greatly. We had quite a lot to do with them in other spheres.
So it seems that you were really living it up at this time.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
We were living by then in a much bigger house than my old Racecourse Road one, where I was a child. We had more servants, a couple of motor cars, I suppose. Nice big house, big fireplaces, freezing cold winters in Tianjin, big fireplaces. We had our private rickshaw. That, by the way, yes. We had a chauffeur to drive the car, and then we had a rickshaw man who took my mother and me out shopping quite often on our private rickshaw, which was much grander than the ones you picked up in the street. But it was a much better way of getting about. No parking. He just drove up to the road, ran up to the shops, and we got out and shopped. So it was a bigger establishment, well to do. I was there during the time of Edward VIII's problems, and I was standing around with all the grown ups drinking their cocktails and having their evenings events, listening to all the chatter about Wallace Simpson. Prince of Wales. I didn't quite know what it was all about, but it was going on at that period, and it was our hot news, of course, and the whole of life was quite exciting. They all worked like anything, but they also had a lot of fun. They had parties galore, and my father was a great rider, of course, so quite often he didn't drink at these parties because he was in training for riding. He was a great jockey, great rider, amateur rider.
Would there have been much regarding sort of ceremonial on the part of the British at this time in Tianjin? You know, did you fly the flag, show the flag?
Yes, we did. Quite a lot. We did. We had a big cenotaph in the Victoria, it was called Victoria Gardens, where I went as a little child with my sister in the armour. And at one armistice day, and by the way, one of the first things I did, of course, was join the Tianjin Municipal Volunteers. We were all mixed, French, English, German, all sorts, Chinese even, in this corps. And when I was to stay, I was a very keen soldier and stood up straight and so on. I stood at the corner of the cenotaph. There were four of us around the cenotaph on Armistice Day with upturned rifles and bugles played. The British garrison would go to church every Sunday, march on our main street called Victoria Street. We're all in the British Consortium in Victoria and very British. Marched up Victoria Street to the church with the bugles playing and winter or summer uniform on according to the season. very well turned out. They came, their officers came to the balls and tennis matches and things that went on. We celebrated royal birthdays. We had the coronation there. George VI was crowned while I was in Tintin. As you know, Prince of Wales had a short innings and off he went, and George VI came in. So there's big doings then. Huge lights on the top of Victoria Hall, which was the main municipal buildings with effigies of George VI and crowns and lights and crack of fireworks going off. So we made a lot of play of being British, we did indeed. Yes. Proud of it. But on the other hand, the Tintin Grammar School was quite mixed when I taught. Chinese boys, French boys, Germans, many white Russians. They were always the head of the class. The Russians were much the cleverest and more energetic. They had more cause to want to climb out of their problems, so they worked harder. But we vaunted our Britishness, surely. Joining us across the bridge was the French concession, and all the young men there did their, by the way, unlike us, they did their, they put on the French uniform and did their national service there in the French concession, whereas we were merely volunteers. And I've got here the blazer badge of the Tintin British Emergency Corps, which shows the sort of...
Oh, yes, that's setup. Lovely, isn't it? Yes, that must be very precious to have. I wouldn't have thought there are many people about who belong to that. Lovely bit of history, isn't it?
It's great
what
stuff.
What is the other one? That looks interesting too.
I was very keen, of course, on all this games, and so took exams and became a football referee.
Oh, with a lovely dragon on.
A Chinese dragon.
Yes.
I think it's a five-clawed dragon.
Yes, it looks as fresh as if it's been done yesterday.
Yes,
it really does. You've looked after that beautifully.
My worn one has disappeared somewhere, but this is my very clean one. And took many games.
Perhaps I could take a photograph later with you holding those two. Right. That would be rather nice.
Oh, good. I thought they might be interesting. I've dug them out.
Well, this is the end of Reel 2, John Davis.